Hey there, everyone. Welcome back to Crude Acts, Murder in an Old Town. This series that we're doing now is about the murder case of Sandy Terrell and Debbie Merritt. And it is an unsolved murder case. And so far, we have talked about the bare bones of the case. In the second episode, we talked a little more about the victims so you can understand who they were. So now, episode 3, here we are. It's time to delve into the investigation and the suspects. And I'm here to tell you, it's a lot of names. There's a whole lot of meat on the bones of this story. I'm going to try to keep it as organized and as linear as possible because it is kind of all over the place and we're working with two different timelines. So there's just a lot of moving parts. So first, we're going to talk with the investigation back then when it kicked off in 1985. And I want to go over the handful of officers who worked on this, from Wayne Clapper to Ron Moser, Robert Merchant, Gene Parker, Rex Elliott, Jamie Glenn, Jim Langford, and then Sergeant Reggie Harper, who was the lead on the missing persons case. And that was out of Baytown. That was in 1985, up until they found the bodies in 1987. And of course, rounding out the investigation team was my father, Paul Schaefer. He was part of the missing persons case as well as the homicide case. There was Harris County Detective Mark Argo, who was added to the homicide investigation, and there's Texas Ranger David Maxwell, who was appointed to the case by Texas Ranger Captain Bob Prince at the request of Chief Hensey, who was Chief of Police of Baytown from 1982 to 1992. And of course, let's not forget Candy, the victim Sandy Terrell's twin sister, who probably put more boots to the ground than all of them combined. And I went over that in the last episode, how Candy talked with a lot of people and collected a lot of names, and she wrote them all down in a little black book. So there are essentially three parts to the case. There's the missing persons case, which was less than 2 years. There's a homicide investigation that was from 1987 to the 1990s, and the cold case where it sits now. And I'm going to take each piece, the who, what, when, where, and why, and lay out how it all fits together. And we're going to start with the beginning. So I have a lot to cover. Let's get going. I'm Jen Schaefer, and this is Crude Acts, Murder in an Old Town, Who Killed Debbie and Sandy. It's December 1985. News spread quickly about the two women who had gone missing, Debbie Merritt and Sandy Terrell. It became the center of town gossip. Rumors began to circulate about them being involved in the Baytown nightlife, talks about the Baytown nightlife, and everyone, of course, had an opinion, like they always do, especially about women, quote, behaving badly. Victim blaming, which, by the way, we're not going to let slide here. But we do have to mention it because it's what happened, and it seems to be that this notion keeps carrying on with the men who have been investigating this case. So I'm going to kick it off with an article in the Houston Chronicle written by Cindy Horswell. The police started to receive tips, and I think she was working simultaneously with some detectives. I know that she talked to my dad, but in the article that I read, she wrote about one of the tips, and it was from an anonymous male caller who, it said in the article that this person told police that victim Debbie Merritt called him before she disappeared, and she asked him if she could borrow $1,000. She told him that she needed to cover expenses before taking a trip to California. She even said to him, and this is a direct quote from the paper, "If I don't return, I'll probably be sold into white slavery." Which really stood out to me because I've never heard that before. The article went on to say the caller was supposed to meet up with the officers to supply further information, but he never showed up and investigators never heard from him again. So the words white slavery stood out to me, of course, not only because it's a strange thing to say and hear, but the only other time I've ever read those words was while researching the Houston mass murders that occurred in the early 1970s. One of the killers, Elmer Wayne Henley Jr., used it when talking about the boys that they lured in and killed. Henley reported to detectives that serial killer Dean Corll told him he worked as a recruiter of a white slave ring operating out of Dallas. So, of course, I had to go and Google white slavery, and this is where I learned something. And it's about the Mann Act, previously called the White Slave Traffic Act of 1910. According to good old Wikipedia, this act made it a felony to engage in the interstate and foreign commerce transport of any woman or girl for the purpose of prostitution and human trafficking. Whether prostitutes participated in it willingly or were forced into it by any cartel-type organization. And that's just something to log in your noggin there. And by the way, the Houston mass murders, I'm going to round out my podcast series on those cases when I'm finished with this one. But I'm going to say this, there are a couple of odd coincidences that the two cases, this murder of Debbie and Sandy and those Houston mass murders in the 1970s, beyond the white slavery comment, that just being one, and there's some more stuff that connect the two in some weird ways, and I'll bring that up later, so just hang tight. So back to Debbie and Sandy. In the beginning, everything regarding their disappearance seemed to keep coming back to this trip to California. The trip they told their family and friends they were going on, and it was a trip that was allegedly set up by Debbie's friend, a guy named Bob, who was a pilot, and he was opening up a new business in California. So when detectives got a lead, specifically a name and description that fit the circumstances of the case, even a photograph of a man in an airline pilot's uniform, they figured they were onto something. And it didn't take long for them to figure out who the guy in the photo was. And when they tracked him down, they were surprised by what they found out about him. So this guy, this tip that they got from people and this photograph that they got from people, this guy, Bob, wasn't actually a pilot. He was a guy that would go out to bars dressed up like a pilot to pick up women. This guy worked in construction and maintenance and lived at home with his ailing wife, who he was caring for at the time. And his name, of course, wasn't Bob. He used an alias, so his wife didn't find out about his extracurricular activities. So investigators questioned him. And when they talked about it, he said that this was the first time he ever hearing about a trip to California. And the last time he saw the two women was months before their disappearance. They, of course, gave him a polygraph test, which he passed with flying colors. His alibis subsequently checked out and he was cleared of any connection to their disappearance. With the tips that they received about this guy, and they received more tips about another couple, a Pasadena couple with the last name Renfro. They talked to, quote, Bob. They never gave his actual name, by the way, but the guy that goes by Bob, he gave them the names too, and supposedly they were the ones who introduced the missing women to the wannabe pilot. And the Renfros, according to the girls, were also supposed to go on that trip to California. But when questioned by officers, the couple, just like Bob, said they knew nothing about the trip and they hadn't seen the women in quite some time. They too were questioned in depth and they were cleared as well. And just like that, detectives were back to square one, now with even more questions than answers. So the questions: was this trip to California a clever diversion planned by whoever abducted them? Or was it a cover story used by the women because they had something else planned that they didn't want their family and friends to know about? Regardless, it seems like the trip was possibly just a ruse. Investigators at this point were running out of leads and running out of steam. It's as if these women were never going to be found, that this would be an unsolved mystery, one that could possibly go on for a lifetime. We know that they found the car at this point, and it re-sparked everything, and this was in 1986, but they got nothing from the car. There was no fingerprints, no hair, like completely wiped down. They got absolutely nothing from it. So then after that, 1986 comes to an end, and it rolls around, and then all of a sudden, it's March 1987, and this is when everyone receives the call that no one wants to get, and that call was that their loved ones have been found, but sadly, not alive. The worst-case scenario had come true. The bodies were found in Chambers County, in a town called Winnie, Texas. Detective Paul Schaefer and Texas Ranger David Maxwell were put on the homicide case because the Texas Rangers can file in multiple jurisdictions, and this case straddled both Harris and Chambers County. Maxwell was the one with most authority and could file charges whenever they needed to be filed. And so he became the lead detective on the homicide case. So after the bodies were found, they went back to the drawing board and they started from the very beginning. They reinvestigated all the family members, the ex-husbands, of course, being the primary ones, Gary Merritt, Debbie's ex-husband, and Jimmy Terrell, Sandy's ex-husband. They gave sworn statements and polygraph tests were administered, and they both passed and seemed to have no direct involvement with the murders, at least. Almost everyone who was connected to the family passed, almost. All except for one. During the course of the missing persons investigation and into the homicide investigation, one person piqued their interest, and it was a name that kept coming up, and he just became a person that they couldn't eliminate. So they kept going back to him. And that man was Debbie Merritt's boss, the owner of ProAd, Mickey Crawford. So who is this guy, Mickey Crawford? His name is Harold Michael Crawford, and of course they called him Mickey. He was born in 1944, and he grew up in Baytown, Texas. He graduated in 1962 from Robert E. Lee High School, the same high school Debbie and Sandy attended years later. In 1966, he got married. They had four kids together on the outside for several years. Everything seemed quite nice and normal, and maybe even for a chunk of time it was. He worked in real estate for a guy that had a real estate firm out of Wimberley. So he did that for a chunk of time, and then it seems that he broke away and he started his own business, ProAd. Now, I'm not sure when Mickey turned down a darker path, but it seems in the 1980s, he got tangled up in a life that led him, well, to become a suspect in a murder case, for one. But allegedly, this is from his own involvement in the Baytown nightlife. And this nightlife seemed to have possibly lured him in with sex, power, money, drugs, and, of course, connections. So let's talk about his business, ProAd. It was a company that made patches for, you know, jackets and caps and, you know, uniforms. They did everything from large orders like uniforms for Baytown Police Department to small orders like uniforms for Little League teams. In an interesting twist, allegedly he landed the Baytown Police Department account through his friendship with none other than Assistant Police Chief Bob Dabney. But Mickey's small business, of course, was only made him enough for him and his family to get by. This was the 80s, a decade of decadence. Everyone wanted more. You'll see in the eye of the storm of this murder case is that very notion, the desperation for more, to acquire more than what life allowed them to have. So Mickey has this business. He lands a big account with Baytown Police Department to do all their uniforms and things like that. We know that the day that Debbie disappeared, she had a box of caps that she was supposed to deliver to ProAd before they took off. And so all of these things just kind of went in on Mickey Crawford here. And they interviewed him. When they interviewed him, though, usually they do it in a private room somewhere. This one was conducted in the lobby of the Baytown Police Department building, and his attorney, Rod Haddix, was by his side. Mr. Haddix actually went to our church, and I was friends with his son, Jason. So they're all there, and according to my father, when he talked about the interview, Mickey was very uncooperative when questioned about the case and specifically about Debbie. And when they asked him to take a polygraph test, he refused. And my dad said he could tell that he was not truthful during the interview, and it didn't last long, and it was just unproductive and a waste of time. He clammed up. He didn't give up a lot of information. So there we go. That ends. But sometime after the interview, and he couldn't remember how many days it was, but after the interview, my dad said he received a phone call from an anonymous male tipster who quickly stated, Mickey will be getting his own polygraph done tomorrow in Houston, and then he quickly hung up. So my dad informed Ranger Maxwell of the call. So they're like, what do we do with this? So they created an action plan, and this is what they did. They set up an early morning surveillance, and they followed Mickey Crawford to his attorney's office. And from there, he was driven in the attorney's car from Baytown to Houston to a private polygraph business. They were there for approximately an hour, and after they left, my dad said he and Maxwell entered the business and spoke with the owner of the polygraph business, who was a retired Houston Police Department officer that David Maxwell actually knew. So because they already had a friendship and he talked to him about the case, the polygraph guy told them that the test that he did confirmed that Crawford did have direct knowledge of the disappearance and murder of the two women. He couldn't conclude that he was involved in it, but he did know about it. He also couldn't continue questioning him. When he went really in depth with those questions, Mickey ripped off the equipment, got up, and stormed out. And just like that, Mickey Crawford became the number one suspect. So with that, police quest for evidence to prove so went underway. When they decided to make their suspicions of Mickey Crawford known to those involved in the investigation, including Candy, Sandy's twin, she told them that she thought he may have had something to do with it as well. Come to find out, it was highly speculated by many people that Debbie Merritt and Mickey Crawford had been having an affair. And she was very active in his business, ProAd. Apparently, she attended work functions with him and networking events and private dinners. And allegedly, she stayed in hotel rooms with him when they would go on these things. With all this intel, detectives decided it was time to look into the company, ProAd. So ProAd was located across the street from the Baytown Police Department. It had a small office up front, and in the back was a warehouse used for storage. The business had a few vehicles registered to it, a car, a delivery truck, and a white cargo van. It was the van that piqued their interest immediately. It was a vehicle that they'd already been looking for because they received a tip about one. An anonymous caller phoned in to the tip line, telling them that he remembered seeing a white cargo van and a Jeep Wrangler driving out on the gravel road where they found the bodies around the same time the women went missing. So, when they found out ProAd had registered to it a white cargo van, they were highly suspicious and they wanted to seize it immediately. So they go to the business to go find it. And when they did, it was missing. And no one knew its whereabouts. When Mickey was asked about it, he said, "Oh, I don't have it anymore." And when asked why, he said he didn't remember. And how long ago did he get rid of it? Again, he couldn't remember. And that van, by the way, was never found. So, according to Candy, Assistant Police Chief Bob Dabney, who in the beginning of the investigation that she handed over a book of names and notes to that was never seen again, was close with Mickey Crawford. And in the book that she gave him, she jotted down his name and that she was suspicious of him. And then there was another name that was mentioned in regards to that. So you've got the name Mickey Crawford, and Candy was talking to my dad and Texas Ranger Maxwell. She mentioned another name, and this woman was named Jan Robbins. Interestingly enough, this woman, Jan Robbins, was once married to a police officer with the nickname of Fat Mac. And when they divorced, she had nowhere to go. And according to the information I received, she reached out to a friend for financial help and a place to crash. And this guy's name was Bobby Jarvis. And he owned the Palms Oasis Lounge. And he put her up in the Palms Motel, which was the motel next door to the bar. So Candy told Detective Schaefer and Ranger Maxwell when she sat down with Assistant Chief Bob Dabney during the missing persons case, she told them that she ended up at the Palms Motel where Jan lived. And when she knocked on her door, a disheveled Jan answered. Her eyes widened and she quickly tried to shut her out. Candy used her foot to stop the door and asked her in a desperate plea to help her find her sister. But Jan bluntly replied to her, "No, there is nothing you can do. They're both dead. Don't come back here again or you'll end up dead too." And then she slammed the door in her face. This was the first time that my dad or Ranger Maxwell heard of such information. So after hearing this, they tried to find a document or a record of the meeting and they couldn't find anything. And they wondered, why did Bob Dabney, friends with Mickey Crawford, not write up a report or even pass on this information? It was very strange. And then, of course, the police objective was to interview Jan themselves. So they tracked her down. They met with her at her place, and she told them all the things that she knew. She's the one who told them about the game Hunt and Chase. She told them that high up people were playing it, but she wouldn't give any names. And she knew the women, and she knew the places where they hung out, and she knew all the people who were connected to them, and most importantly, the people that they hung out with out at these different places. For a short while, she was very cooperative, until one day she clammed up and she didn't want to speak with them anymore. And she let them know it was because she was afraid. So, what was she afraid of? I'm going to read to you an official police report. It was taken by another assistant chief investigator named R.P. Merchant. The date was May 7th, 1987, a couple of months after the bodies were found, the subject of the report is labeled unauthorized interference with a material witness. And the person involved in this is an unknown male police officer. And this is the report that R.P. Merchant wrote. May 6th, 1987, Thursday. I received a phone call from Deputy Paul Schaefer, Chambers County Sheriff's Office, who is investigating the homicide of two missing females, Sandra Ruth Terrell, white female, 36 years old, and Deborah Elizabeth Merritt, white female, 35 years old. Deputy Schaefer stated that he had received a phone call from Jan Robbins, who is a very important material witness in the above investigation, and she advised him that yesterday, Wednesday, May 6th, 1987, that she talked to a Baytown police officer whose name she would not reveal, and that this officer is alleged to have told her not to get involved in the case and told her that she was talking too much about the case. She also said that this officer stated that Chief Hensey thinks she is involved and that the best thing she could do is get a good attorney. Deputy Schaefer is concerned that this will be harmful to the case, to which I agreed. I then called Mrs. Robbins on the phone, and she advised me that she had known this officer for a long time, and she gave me the impression that the officer is a male and has been with the department for a very long time. She stated that she is worried and concerned about what the officer said. The officer is alleged to have said, Maxwell is not going to believe you and he thinks you are involved in prostitution and drugs. The officer went on to say that sometimes you tell too much and told her that she probably had told too much already and she ought to just be quiet, and he advised her to get a damn good attorney. She stated she was worried and was wondering if the officers were trying to build a case against her. She stated that she had been working with Ranger David Maxwell and Deputy Paul Schaefer in the case involving the two deceased women. She went on to say that she was afraid they were going to get a warrant on her. She stated she contacted Deputy Schaefer because she wanted to know if there was a warrant out for her and what was going on. She stated she wasn't involved in any wrongdoing and didn't feel she needed an attorney. She refused to name the officer at this time, but agreed to name him after the investigation was completed. I further assured her if the officer was saying those things, that it was totally improper. End report. So that was the report. And the number one question, of course, is who was this officer? Who was she so afraid of? We know that this is an unsolved case, that the investigation was never completed. So the name of the officer was never given up. But let's look at who it could have been. And we'll start looking into the man who, quote, took care of her and put her up in the motel because she had nowhere else to go. The guy that took care of her that I told you about, named Bobby Jarvis. So upon researching him, I came to discover this guy, Bobby Jarvis, that, quote, helped her out, was what law enforcement called a no-good son of a gun. And that's a direct quote from a retired detective. Jarvis was a documented criminal, and he had a long rap sheet, including blackmail, extortion, manufacturing, and smuggling illegal narcotics, including meth, cocaine, marijuana. And he had a strong affiliation with a very well-known motorcycle club, the Bandidos. So in 1970s, Jarvis ran a seafood restaurant in Baytown called the Bay Reef. He then owned several bars around town, a few in Crosby, including but not limited to Texas Saloon, Mine and Yours Nightclub, and Palms Oasis Lounge, all of which were known to host local shady characters and powerful money men alike. Debbie Merritt and Sandy Terrell were also known to frequent all of these establishments. I read a few articles in the Baytown Sun about the Palms Oasis Lounge that he co-owned with a Houston businessman named Donald C. Gemmer. The lounge was next to the Palms Motel and was known for drugs and prostitution. The bar was under constant surveillance and scrutiny, and then city officials, especially because they featured topless entertainment at the bar without having the license to do so. Local pastors, some political figures, including Baytown Mayor Alan Cannon, who was mayor for a short time in the 80s, and even Chief Hensy himself, tried to get his TABC license revoked and the bar shut down. But it just never seemed to work. So come to find out, as far as friendships go, it was alleged that Bobby Jarvis had two strong friendships with Baytown police officers, both Assistant Chief Bob Dabney, who was also friends with Mickey Crawford, and another officer named J.C. Deal. And I was able to track down and speak with Bobby Jarvis's stepson. And this guy lived in Baytown during the early to mid 80s with Bobby Jarvis. And this guy, and I'll talk about him later, and I'll go into my interview with him. But he corroborated the information that he was friends with Bob Dabney and especially J.C. Deal. And he said that the four of them, he, Bobby, J.C. Deal, and his son, who's also a police officer, would go out fishing together. So they were close. And it's very strange to me that this, quote, no good son of a gun, who had all these illegal things that he was doing, that he was tight friends with local law enforcement. So who was he? Who else was he connected to? How deep and wide did this guy, Jarvis, how deep and wide did his network go? What was going on in Baytown in the 1980s that would foster such a network? And then, of course, how are the women connected? How did the women, the victims, end up in the eye of the storm? And we are going to talk about those things in upcoming episodes, because that is all the time I have for now. So stay tuned for the next episode. We're going to go down this Oil Town rabbit hole. We're kicking off this thing with the names: Mickey Crawford, Bobby Jarvis, Assistant Police Chief Bob Dabney, Police Officer J.C. Deal. These are only the names in the very beginning of this. So there's going to be more connections, and there's going to be more police reports as well. So get ready for those. Again, I'm Jen Schaefer, and this is Crude Acts, Murder in an Oil Town. I'm the one who researches and writes and tells the story here. Russell Dunlap helps produce and makes this thing sound so fresh and so clean. And he's the one that adds the music and just makes this sound good. Amy Dunlap manages and keeps things on track. And I record this out in Cabin 76 podcast studio outside the Houston Heights. The opening song is by Two Star Symphony. Go check them out. They are fabulous. You can check us out at www.crudax.com. And you can read about us. You can listen to the episodes there. I'll start adding more fun stuff, more behind-the-scenes stuff there as well as this thing develops. I only have so much time, though. And I'm going to end this, by the way, stating that I'm recording this today, Thursday, November 23rd. It's Thanksgiving, so happy Thanksgiving, everyone. Remember the three Fs here: family, food, football, all the things that definitely us in the South love. So enjoy those things. I have a lot of thank yous to give out. And, you know, there's a lot of people who've been listening to my podcast from the very beginning and have been supporting me. And I may not, like, I don't want to start on my list now and my announcements now. Just know that I see you and I appreciate you. I'm really just honored to be able to tell this story. Candy and Tammy Terrell, I'm doing this for you guys. And Sandy deserves this, and Debbie deserves this. This is something that is really dear to my heart. So getting down to the bottom of this, I don't take this lightly. Throwing around names like this, I've done a lot of research and a lot of talking with people. Of course, my father being the main guy, but other investigators who don't really wish to be named because there's a lot to this. So I'm just excited to share with you about what I've found. Thank you so much. Stay tuned for the next one. We left off here at Bobby Jarvis. We're going to talk about him and more connections. And like I said, there'll be more police reports to talk about as well as the autopsy. So stay tuned for that. And I will see you guys next time. All right. Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving. Bye-bye.